because that way you get both taxable workers now and babies, a future generation of taxable workers. But for years, neither the government nor Japanese business could get out of the mindset that women should stay home with the children while ambitious men worked 70-hour weeks. But things seem to have snapped in 2005, when the Japanese population actually began shrinking. Deaths outnumbered births for the first time since the last years of World War II. And as a result, the government has been talking a new language since 2005. Japanese bureaucrats discovered flex time. They discovered work-life balance. And they began talking about the need for government and business to support working men and women, both as parents, in law and in policy. This is a sea change from the attitudes that prevailed in Japan for most of the post-war era. Now, the early results are actually promising. The birth rate stopped dropping and has actually ticked up a bit since 2005. But reversing Japan's shrinking population will only happen as part of a series of broader changes. Changing attitudes towards family structure, a new understanding of gender roles, and new attitudes towards work in an era of sluggish economic growth. And if that sounds familiar, it's because many of the challenges facing Japanese families are similar to those facing families around the developed world.
Lecture 21, Japanese Foodways.
The Japanese like food. Lots of different kinds of food. And while I'm sure most of you know the basics of Japanese cuisine, sushi and sake, today I'd like to move beyond those basics to the enormous diversity and complexity of Japanese cuisine, or what many now call today Japanese foodways, the culture of food. So we'll talk first about contemporary Japanese food culture, and then we'll trace it back through cycles of Japanese isolation and globalization. Now, something striking about Japanese foodways is the sheer number of restaurants in Japan. In fact, Japan has twice as many restaurants per capita as the U.S. One restaurant for every 260 or so people. In the U.S., it's more like one per 560. In Tokyo alone, there are an estimated 160,000 restaurants. That's 10 times as many as New York. In fact, there are more ramen noodle shops in Tokyo than total restaurants in New York. And what's remarkable is that this isn't new. Tokyo has had thousands of restaurants for hundreds of years. So, this long-standing density of restaurants, what can it tell us about Japanese culture? Why are there so many restaurants in Japan? Well, one answer is that the Japanese like to eat out. That may sound obvious, but Japanese homes are small. And until recently, Japanese kitchens were extremely simple, perhaps one or two gas burners. And in fact, ovens are still somewhat rare in Japan. That's why the Japanese invented the bread machine. Now, because homes are small, having people over for dinner, hosting a dinner party, simply isn't as common in Japan as it is in the U.S. On the contrary, people tend to choose specific restaurants where they go to relax informally and others where they go to entertain. Now, Japanese restaurants are rather small. It's not unusual to find a shop with only 10 or even 5 seats. So a restaurant can actually feel like an extension of one's home. If you're a regular, you get to know the owner, you get to know his or her family, the other patrons, and they get to know you. So for me, at my regular places, the host might ask, has your family come to join you yet? Or they might say, we have your favorite dish today. Now, restaurants and drinking establishments in Japan often have clear identities and distinct clienteles. For example, a friend in broadcasting once took me to a bar where the clientele was entirely people in broadcasting. And the bartender knew the details of the business. And he could respond thoughtfully to patrons when they talk shop. This is also true of hostess clubs. Those are drinking establishments with a large female staff who pay lavish attention to their male clients. Now, in some cases, hostess clubs fall into a gray area, fading into escort services and prostitution. But in many cases, the appeal is largely conversation. I know someone who worked at a hostess club patronized by firefighters, and she learned enough in conversation at work that she could explain in detail different strategies for firefighting in Japan. And the key point here is that in Japan, when you invite someone to your favorite restaurant, you're inviting them into your social sphere. These small restaurants and bars feel very personal. Now, a second consequence of lots of tiny restaurants is that they specialize. They serve one type of food. If you eat Japanese food in the U.S., you'll often be presented with a thick menu that includes sushi and sashimi and udon and soba and tempura and okonomiyaki and teriyaki salmon. But in Japan, a big, extensive menu like that is commonly associated with big chain restaurants. Colorful laminated menus with pictures, maybe near a highway interchange, mass-produced food at a low price, but of middling quality. And most Japanese consumers just don't think that you can do that many types of food well in a small restaurant. If you're a sushi chef, you make sushi. Soba shops make soba. If you're a tempura restaurant, you make tempura. It's not considered likely that in a small independent restaurant, you could be good at all three. So Japanese restaurants commonly do one thing. Sushi, that's one thing. Soba and udon are considered one thing. Soba is buckwheat noodles and udon are wheat noodles. Both are boiled and served either drained or in a light broth. But ramen, that's something else. Because the broth is rich and fatty and it cooks for hours. So many restaurants do ramen noodles or soba and udon, but not both. Tempura. That's quickly fried vegetables and shrimp. That's yet another thing. And it's completely separate from tonkatsu, which is a fried pork cutlet. And that's different from kushiage or kushikatsu. Those are deep-fried skewers of meat and seafood and vegetables. Now, at a kushikatsu restaurant, you can probably get different cuts of chicken on skewers. But that's considered distinct from yakitori, which is chicken on skewers, but it's grilled, not fried. And that's considered distinct from yakiniku, which is grilled meat, usually beef, but the customers grill it at their own table, whereas yakitori is grilled by the chef. So, for each of these dishes, you will find specialized restaurants, lots of them. But in addition to being highly specialized, Japanese dining is also highly contextual. There are slightly different rituals that apply to different types of restaurant. For example, with kushikatsu, there's one bowl of dipping sauce for the table, so it's bad form to double dip. But with tonkatsu, you have your own dish of sauce. And with yakitori, you generally don't add sauce. The chef should have properly basted it. Now, I don't want to make Japan overly exotic. All cultures have rules for how you eat. But for centuries, the Japanese have reveled in discussing and reading about the right way to eat this or that. What's the right season? What's the right restaurant? What are the right manners? There's a brilliant and loving parody of these attitudes in the 1985 film Tampopo. So the story centers around a struggling ramen restaurant. And in one scene, it involves a ramen master, a man who has studied ramen for 40 years. And he is instructing a disciple on the correct way to eat ramen. The master is dressed in a formal kimono. And he carefully explains that first one sits and quietly observes the gestalt of the ramen. Then one caresses the surface of the ramen with chopsticks to express affection and appreciation. And only then can one touch the pork slices with chopsticks. And that's only while saying words of thanks to the pork. Now, my description can't do justice to this scene. Please see the movie. Because it's funny largely because it's a parody of real Japanese behavior. There are rituals around almost every category of Japanese cuisine. You may notice a parallel here with the Japanese language, which incorporates formality and ritual even in everyday situations. Now, there's also a great sense of seasonality with food in Japan. Some foods are associated with certain festivals and holidays and times of year. But even in ordinary daily eating in Japan, there's an awareness of what's in season and what's not. It's something we once had in American culture, and foodies and locavores are reviving it, but in Japan, it never disappeared. For example, the fish samma. It's known in English by the ungainly terms mackerel pike and Pacific souri. It's considered at its best in fall. If you eat it too early, it's not fatty enough. If you wait too long, it's gone or it's only available frozen. And samma has become my restaurant test. Whenever I encounter a 22-page laminated menu at a Japanese restaurant in the U.S., my test is to order, in Japanese, salt-grilled samma, shioyaki samma, when it's out of season. And then I wait for the answer. And the right response, the answer I am hoping for, is a long pause, a concerned face, and then a polite suggestion that I order something else. Perhaps hirame. That's considered delicious longer into the winter. Or if it's summer, maybe suzuki. But if the server just smiles and says, oh yes, shioyaki-sama coming up, I change the order and I adjust my expectations for the food way down. Okay, let's turn from the contemporary scene and talk about the backstory to Japanese foodways. And in particular, let's address this question. How do Japanese foodways reflect the waves of Japanese globalization and isolation that we've discussed throughout this course? Well, remember that wet rice agriculture itself came from China and the Korean Peninsula. And although no one in Japan today would consider rice especially Chinese, many ancient Japanese foodways reflect that early wave of Chinese and continental influence. For example, soy sauce brewing. It came from the continent. So did fermented bean paste. It's called miso. And so did noodles, which go back to the 700s in Japan. But ancient Japanese cuisine was still distinctive in several ways. Some of our oldest records of Japanese foodways emphasize eating things raw. Sashimi, for example, is very old. It dates to the Heian period. In the earliest records, fish was sliced thin and dipped in vinegar. Soy sauce became popular once commercial brewing developed. And using vinegar for preservation is also very old. Makizushi, a cylindrical type of sushi, actually started as a means of preserving fish by wrapping it in vinegar-coated rice. And so the Japanese preference for fish or seafood over meat, that goes back many centuries. But everything in traditional Japanese cuisine, everything is secondary to rice. long considered the staff of life in Japan. And that's reflected in language. Meshi is a casual term for rice, but it can also mean a meal. And gohan is the polite term for rice, and it can also mean a meal. Now, there's an equivalent in English. Bread means food, as in, give us this day our daily bread. But in colloquial English, that meaning of bread as food in general, it's almost disappeared. In Japanese, however, rice continues to mean food, even though today, Japan consumes almost as much wheat as rice. Now, a simple Japanese meal, going back to the medieval era, was defined as rice, and then a soup and a vegetable. That's known as ichiju isai. Ichiju, one soup, and isai, one side dish. A more substantial meal would be one soup and three sides, ichiju sansai. Now, in Japanese restaurants abroad, servers will often bring the soup before the rest of the meal. That's European style. Soup as a separate course. But that's completely wrong. Basic Japanese soups are designed to complement plain rice. You generally don't put anything on rice in Japan. Instead, you alternate sips of soup and mouthfuls of rice. So bringing the soup first is like serving rice and beans with the beans first, and then when you're done with the beans, here's some plain white rice. Or maybe like serving bread and butter separately. Here's a nice thick pat of butter, eat that, and then when you're done, here's some bread. Now, a basic Japanese broth going back centuries is made from kombu or sea kelp, and often with shavings of bonito. That's a large fish similar to tuna. This can be a clear broth, or one can add miso paste, or tofu, or different mushrooms, depending on the season and the level of extravagance. Now, because rice was considered the main dish, anything served in addition to soup was called a side dish, okazu. That could be fish or vegetables. But until modern times, animal protein was quite rare in the Japanese diet. That was in part for economic reasons and partly because of a Buddhist aversion to animal slaughter. And this was especially strict for livestock like cows and pigs. So until the 1800s, Japan had limited animal husbandry, not much cattle or pork, and virtually no dairy products. Poultry and eggs were more common than beef or pork, but still quite rare. Fish and shellfish, the most common animal products, were still unusual for the most part. Most Japanese were de facto vegetarians until the modern period. Now, when we talk about the Japanese diet, historically, we need to take account of class. Because while most of the Japanese population worked as farmers, until the 20th century, and they grew lots of rice, rice was still a luxury grain. To eat highly polished white rice, that was a sign of great wealth. Most commoners ate less polished rice, stretched with a less desirable grain like millet. Now the irony here is that brown rice, stretched with millet, is quite healthy as a staple grain, and highly polished white rice is not. In the absence of animal products such as pork, or vegetables like kale or cauliflower, or fruits like oranges, in the absence of those, a diet rich in white rice leads to a deficiency of vitamin B1, thiamine. And that leads to a breakdown of the nervous system, with symptoms like mental confusion, difficulty walking, and cardiovascular problems. Collectively, those are symptoms of the disease beriberi. Now, until the late 1800s, beriberi was rare, and it was a sign of affluence. Shoguns sometimes suffered from beriberi, but ordinary people almost never. But it became tragically common as Japan got richer, and more people could eat white rice. But this was when meat was not yet cheap enough to be a regular part of the diet. And the Japanese military spent years trying to figure out why their young recruits who were devouring white rice and thinking they were eating better than ever kept getting sick. Okay, during Japan's second wave of globalization, the 1400s and the 1500s, Japan's traditional diet didn't change dramatically. But contact with the West did bring some innovations. For example, the Japanese developed a type of sponge cake called castera, which was an adaptation of the Portuguese dish pão de castela, or bread from Castile. Tempura also seems to have come by way of Portugal. It's a corruption of the Portuguese word temporas, meaning days or time, and that refers to the four times of year when Portuguese Catholics avoided meat, and therefore they ate fried vegetables and fish. And it was also in the 1500s that Japanese warlords developed a taste for Western wines. But, ironically, the big transformation of the Japanese diet, it didn't happen until the 1700s, during a period of relative isolation. And that's because the 1700s were a period of extended peace, relative prosperity, and urbanization, all great things for food culture. Remember, under the Tokugawa, Japan enjoyed domestic peace for over 250 years. And the shogun's capital of Edo was transformed from a sleepy fishing village to a bustling city of over a million people. And this new population was of two types. First, daimyo and their retainers. And second, the huge numbers of tradesmen and merchants who provided for them. Now, the daimyo were required to spend about half their time in Edo, and they brought with them their high-ranking samurai retainers. So there was a wealthy and powerful elite in Edo. And since there was no war, instead of competing on the battlefield, they competed in the dining room. Daimyo began hosting lavish dinners to entertain themselves and to show off, and this led to an explosion in the demand for things like kaiseki, highly formal Japanese dining. Kaiseki drew from the formality of the tea ceremony, with an exacting concern for presentation, but it included lots of courses, often 14. Sakizuke, an appetizer. Hassun, a seasonal specialty. Mukozuke, a seasonal sashimi. Takiawase, a dish with several things steamed together, and so forth. As for the samurai who attended their lords in Edo, there developed unwritten rules for banquets. If you got a promotion, then you were expected to invite your colleagues to a banquet of a certain size and a certain caliber of restaurant. Now, this elite was supported by hundreds of thousands of tradesmen and merchants. Carpenters, masons, roofers, shopkeepers, and their appetite spawned the growth of thousands of places for quick eats and thousands of food carts. So tempura, which technically was adapted from Portuguese food in the 1500s, became very popular during the Edo boom. It's then that we see lots of food carts and stalls and restaurants serving tempura to busy workers and tradesmen. The Edo period also saw the spread of another foreign food, the sweet potato. It was probably introduced via the Philippines and China. And the sweet potato was promoted by the 8th shogun, Tokugawa Yoshimune, because it was a way to use dry fields. Those were fields unsuited to rice cultivation. And today, sweet potatoes appear everywhere in Japan, roasted at street carts, fried in tempura, or turned into imo shochu, a fiercely strong clear liquor popular in the Southwest. Now, in the late 1800s, Japan experienced another huge wave of globalization, with Japanese traveling to Europe the New World and China and foreigners coming to Japan. And the Western impact on the Japanese diet was enormous. A flood of new foods entered Japan. You see, Japanese observers were not quite sure why Westerners were bigger or why they were more powerful militarily. But they assumed that it was at least partly due to the Western diet. So the government aggressively promoted cattle ranching and dairy production instead of discouraging animal husbandry as in the past. Now the government promoted it. And this led to the invention of new dishes. Dishes specifically created to use new ingredients. The first new dish was probably sukiyaki. Sukiyaki with beef. The first beef sukiyaki restaurant opened in 1862. Sukiyaki involves a huge pot at the center of a table with a broth consisting of soy sauce, sugar, and sake. And the diners put in their choice of onions, cabbage, tofu, mushrooms, noodles, and most important, beef. Thin slices of beef. So modern sukiyaki is actually based on older dishes that did not use beef. But after the 1860s, sukiyaki was changed forever. It's now a beef dish. In this period, food writers responded to this new fascination with foreign foods. They wrote the first cookbooks explaining how to use Western ingredients. These cookbooks date from the 1870s. And tonkatsu, fried pork cutlets, that seems to date from the 1890s. Now, another key development during the 19th century was the stronger influence of continental Asian cuisine. In the Edo period, Nagasaki had the only Chinatown in all of Japan. So while at least one daimyo chose to cater a Chinese banquet, Chinese food was rare. But in the late 1800s, thousands of Chinese workers came to Yokohama and Kobe, and Chinese food became increasingly available as standard foreign food. And this led to hybrid foods. Japanese people associated Chinese food with noodles, so they created Chinese-style noodle dishes unknown in China. One is Hayashi Chuka. It's a summer dish. Cold ramen noodles topped with things like sliced pork, thin slices of Japanese omelet, ginger, and cucumber. And because of Chinese and Korean influence, Japan began to use more garlic. Garlic was rare in older dishes, but today you'll find garlicky dishes like kimchi throughout Japan. But before I get too hungry, let's conclude by returning to an opening point, the social aspect of food. In Japan, eating out with friends is an important alternative to inviting them over to dinner. And so Japan has lots of restaurants. And this love of eating out has only intensified in recent decades. In 2007, the famous Michelin Guide began issuing an edition for Japan. And they awarded 191 stars to 150 restaurants in Tokyo. That's compared to 97 stars for Paris and 54 for New York. So that's pretty impressive. But as for three-star restaurants, Michelin found only 8 in Tokyo compared to 10 in Paris. And that left Japanese foodies thoroughly irate. Japanese critics insisted that Michelin really didn't understand Japanese food. Some Japanese chefs claimed that they had not been rated because they just ignored approaches from Michelin. And this was seen as a challenge. And by 2013, Tokyo had pushed to 15 three-star establishments, completely eclipsing 10 for Paris and 7 for New York. Now, I don't want to suggest that Michelin is a truly scientific benchmark, but it's certainly remarkable that even after years of slow economic growth, the Japanese are supporting so many three-star restaurants and taking world-class cuisine as a point of pride. And while those Michelin stars may be new, as a historian, I know that the joy of eating out is part of a long-standing Japanese tradition.
Lecture 22, Japan's Economic Miracle.
Beginning soon after World War II and continuing into the 1980s, the Japanese economy grew at an astonishing rate. Unprecedented in Japanese history and arguably unprecedented in the history of the world. The overall numbers are incredible. In the 20 years between 1955 and 1975, the Japanese economy grew more than 435%. That's inflation adjusted, that's real growth. So no wonder economists refer to this as the period of the Japanese miracle. Now in the early 21st century, the chatter is all about the Chinese economic miracle. But two things make the Japanese case notable in my mind. First, it set the precedent for the rest of Asia. The idea that Westerners would buy an expensive durable good, like a TV or a car, from a faraway East Asian country, that trail was blazed by Japan. In the 1950s, made in Japan meant cheap novelties. But by the 1980s, made in Japan meant high-quality, innovative products. And the second thing that makes the Japanese economic miracle stand out is that this entire run of growth from the 1950s onward occurred during a period of free and openly contested elections in a stable multi-party democracy. So think by comparison of Taiwan and South Korea, two countries that also saw dramatic growth in the latter half of the 20th century. Well, that growth was initially fostered under one-party rule or military rule. Now, both of those countries made relatively peaceful transitions to multi-party democracies. Mainland China is still a work in progress on that score. But in Japan, there was never a dictatorship to force from power. So in the 1980s, political scientists were writing books like Japan as Number One. They observed that Japan had high rates of economic growth, high income equality, high literacy, high life expectancy, virtually no street crime, free and fair elections, labor unions. And the question was, what's the secret formula? Can anyone bottle this? Of course, since the 1990s, the bloom is off that rose. And 20 years of sluggish economic growth mean that Japan is no longer the economic model it used to be. But for today, let's stick with the boom years. And above all, let's ask the question, why did the Japanese economy grow so fast? Well, I'm going to identify and discuss six factors over the next few minutes. And here's the first. The Japanese economy grew rapidly after World War II because the U.S. wanted it to. The U.S., which was nearly half the world economy in the post-war era, wanted Japan to be a model of capitalism for the developing world. China had gone communist. India was politically neutral. Korea was divided and devastated by war. So if anyone was going to believe that industrial capitalism could succeed outside the West, the U.S. needed a success story. The U.S. needed Japan to become both an export giant and an industrial giant. Now, a key element of this strategy was a cheap yen. In 1949, the value of the yen was set low against the dollar, 360 yen to the dollar. This encouraged Japanese exports by making Japanese products seem cheap to American consumers. And for many years, the Japanese economy was so small that the U.S. could easily absorb its exports without any impact on U.S. industries. You can see the widespread support for this policy in a 1960 Time magazine cover. The image is of a Japanese phoenix rising from burning rubble. Behind the phoenix are gleaming new factories, chemical plants, oil tanks, and huge ships and office buildings. And there in the foreground, beaming with pride, is the Japanese Prime Minister, Kishino Busuke. Now, Henry Luce, who owned Time magazine, was a passionate anti-communist. And although he had supported the Chinese Nationalist Party, the Kuomintang, against Japan during World War II, he was now committed to supporting Japanese capitalism against communism. And in that light, it's worth noting that Prime Minister Kishi had been indicted as a war criminal, mostly for his work promoting the economic development of Manchuria. But charges against him were dropped, and he was rehabilitated, partly because the U.S. became more concerned with making Japan an anti-communist model than with punishing Japanese militarism. So the role of the U.S. is beyond question. And when the biggest economy in the world wants your economy to grow, that's a big help. But the second big factor in Japan's stunning economic growth was largely homegrown. And that was its cheap and motivated workforce. While much of Japan's industrial plant was destroyed in the war, its workers still had the experience of the basic rhythms of industrial life, showing up on time, punching a time clock. And the process of pulling workers out of the fields and into the cities, that had happened in the 1910s and the 1920s. Now, here we get to multiple causes. Japanese labor was fairly quiescent, in part because Japan's unions were fairly apolitical. And that's partly because from the late 1940s, with the intensification of the Cold War, the U.S. occupation barred communists from union activity. But workers were also highly motivated because during all those years of economic growth, Japanese management made sure that the gains showed up in worker paychecks. And in many large companies, workers could count on lifetime employment. By convention, large companies didn't lay off full-time workers during recessions. And workers were assumed to reciprocate by sticking with their employers, rather than seeking higher wages at rival firms. And that sense of allegiance to a company was also supported by the corporate pay scale. In Japan, the management-to-worker salary ratio was astonishingly small. Today, the average U.S. CEO makes in a day what an average worker makes in a year. The ratio is roughly 350-1. That's up from about 40-1 in the 1980s. But in Japan, the ratio was still in the teens as late as the 1990s. So for all these reasons, workers actually felt a connection to their employer. So if management told the Mitsubishi auto workers that they were part of the Mitsubishi family, it seemed reasonable. Mitsubishi was a steady employer, and the Mitsubishi management felt like part of the same broad middle class. Workers could easily be convinced that the real enemy was not management, but their rivals at Toyota. Now, a third and related factor was quality. Japanese businesses took these motivated and cooperative workers and got them to embrace quality targets. A widespread corporate practice was to treat workers with respect and dignity and pay them well and tell them that quality should be their goal, and praise workers who pointed out defects or inefficiencies, get their insights into how to improve quality and reduce defects, and thereby make everyone in a company responsible for and proud of the product. So where did Japanese companies get these ideas? Well, here, Japanese industrialists were incredibly devious. They actually listened to the recommendations of their American advisors. Pretty tricky, huh? In particular, Japanese businessmen for decades celebrated one advisor, William Edwards Deming. In fact, in 1951, the Union of Japanese Scientists and Engineers created the Deming Prize in his honor. And it would be another three decades before he was recognized in the U.S. Deming was an engineer and a statistician. And he was actually brought to Japan by the U.S. occupation to work on the 1951 Japanese census. But he also gave an influential series of lectures on quality control. That was his actual passion. Now, Deming's early work has since been eclipsed by total quality doctrines like TQM and Six Sigma. But Deming pioneered the key ideas behind those later doctrines. First and foremost, quality is not about removing defective products at the end of the assembly line. It's about not making defective products in the first place. Every stage of management and production should be geared towards making a perfect product. And in that way, the final inspection, before the product goes to the consumer, that becomes simply a confirmation of a great job. Now, in the 1950s, Deming's ideas were radical. Managers, he insisted, should not be feared. Their job was not to discipline workers. Instead, Deming said that workers want to be productive and efficient and proud of their work. Managers just make that happen. Today, we would say managers should empower workers. But Deming just said they need to help people and machines and gadgets do a better job. He also told managers to honor every worker's right to pride of workmanship. I find that idea breathtaking. Workers have a right to pride in their work. Now, overall, Deming's idea was that poor quality is the result of bad management. Because if your workers actually want to make a great product, well, then managing is just helping workers do what they already want to do. Now, Japanese businessmen heard Deming's talks and seminars, and they were amazed. Akio Morita, the founder and CEO of Sony, he spoke of Deming's lectures as quasi-religious experiences. Akio said he never thought the same way again. And following Deming's lead, Japanese manufacturers began integrating design and production to lower defects and improve quality. And they included advice from shop floor workers, and they made the goal of constantly improving manufacturing techniques part of their corporate culture. And remember, in this quest for high quality, Japanese companies already had the advantages of relatively low wages and an artificially low currency. If you add high-quality products to the mix, that explains a lot of double-digit growth. So we've explored three factors that drove the Japanese economic miracle: vigorous U.S. support, a cheap and motivated workforce, and an emphasis on quality. And here's a fourth big factor. From the 1950s well into the 1970s, Japanese companies benefited from research and development conducted in the West. Companies in the U.S. and Europe developed cutting-edge technologies, which they were willing to license or sell to Japan. One example is the liquid crystal display. RCA actually developed the LCD, which is now everywhere. Your smartphone display is a massive LCD. So is a flat-screen TV. And yet, RCA sold patent licenses to Japanese companies, which then pioneered massive LCDs and dominated the market. And this happened in multiple industries. Japanese steelmakers were quick to adopt the basic oxygen process furnace, even though the original patent was British and the experimental prototype was American. So why did Western companies sell or license their patents instead of developing those products on their own? Well, one obvious reason was that the Japanese were starting from scratch. For example, the U.S. was slow to adopt new steel technology because the industry already had a huge infrastructure in place. It would have been a really tough decision to start tearing down working steel mills to try a new technology, and an experimental technology at that. But the war had destroyed much of Japan's infrastructure. They were building from scratch anyway. And there was something deeper. In the post-war period, Japanese companies were largely insulated from short-term market forces. They could afford to try new technologies, technologies requiring years of development, and they could bear those costs, even if it meant short-term losses. When the U.S. electronics industry and auto industries were collapsing, Akio Morita famously said, the one thing he would change about U.S. business culture is quarterly financial reporting. That, he argued, made it impossible to do the sort of long-term investment needed for innovation. So what was different in Japan? What insulated Japanese companies from short-term market forces? Well, that question brings us to our fifth big factor behind Japan's economic miracle, the financing of Japanese business. You see, during the post-war boom, Japanese businesses relied more on loans than on stock sales. Japanese businesses, even big businesses, were a lot like U.S. small businesses. They weren't reliant on big public stock offerings. Instead, they borrowed money. And that meant that government loan guarantees were incredibly powerful. If you needed a bank loan for your business, you could go it alone, or you could follow the government's economic plan. Now, as part of the government's economic plan, the Japanese government targeted key industries for growth, and then it supported them by guaranteeing their bank loans. So while government ministry guidelines were technically voluntary, if you followed government advice and you built a steel plant in compliance with the government's plan to develop a steel industry, well, then you got a steady line of credit. And not just from official government banks, but also from private lenders. Now, that question of investment capital, that gets us into another key aspect of post-war industry. Many Japanese companies were part of complex webs of cross-ownership and investing. So when Japanese corporations did raise capital by selling stock, the investors were often affiliated companies. And when they got loans, it was often from affiliated banks. In Japanese, these webs of affiliated companies are called keiretsu. The major keiretsu of the post-war era were Mitsubishi, Mitsui, Sumitomo, and Yaseda. And the largest keiretsu had affiliates in virtually every industry. The Mitsubishi Group, for example, is today comprised of over 500 major companies, including Mitsubishi Motors, Mitsubishi Aircraft, Mitsubishi Steel, Nikon Corporation, Mitsubishi Plastics, Mitsubishi Paper Mills, Kirin Brewery Company, and the Bank of Tokyo Mitsubishi UFJ, which was for a century known simply as Mitsubishi Bank. Most keiretsu had pre-war roots. Some go back to the 1800s. And the occupation briefly considered breaking them down into small independent companies. But that plan was shelved as part of the Cold War goal of rebuilding Japan's economy. So the reforms were limited to some rather superficial restructuring. Now, in terms of investment, Mitsubishi affiliates like Mitsubishi Bank funded the other affiliates. And in addition, the different affiliates all bought each other's stock. And they all bought each other's products. Mitsubishi cars were built with Mitsubishi steel. And all those sorts of deals insulated the companies from any quarter-to-quarter market pressures. So If Mitsubishi Aircraft or Mitsubishi Motors had a rough quarter and their profits plummeted, their access to investment capital was virtually unchanged. Mitsubishi Real Estate didn't dump their shares. Investors didn't demand immediate cost-cutting to restore profitability. Mitsubishi Bank didn't call in a loan. They were all in it together for the long term. Now, it's difficult to quantify exactly how powerful the Keidetsu were during Japan's era of rapid growth. But we can say that until the financial crisis of the 1990s, nearly 60% of the large firms in the Tokyo Stock Exchange were affiliated with one of six large Keidetsu. And the Japan Fair Trade Commission has estimated that almost 90% of domestic business transactions were among parties involved in a long-standing relationship of some sort. And this is a good place to pivot to a sixth and final factor in Japanese economic growth, the role of the Japanese government itself. Now, we've already touched on loan guarantees, but how else did government policy drive economic growth? Now, direct government action was extremely important in the early post-war era. There were several Japanese ministries that promoted economic development. The Ministry of International Trade and Industry, known as MITI, was initially the most powerful. And in the 1950s, MITI targeted several key sectors for growth. The first sectors included steel, electric power, shipbuilding, and chemical fertilizers. And then came synthetic textiles, plastics, and automobiles. And in order to promote these industries, MITI, as I noted, either offered direct government loans or provided loan guarantees to private banks, and it offered government land at low cost, and it offered special tax breaks, everything from accelerated depreciation of capital costs to exemptions from income tax. And there's little question that these policies worked because Japan became the biggest shipbuilder in the world in the 1950s. And nearly 60% of that industry's capital came from government banks. But equally important was the government's inaction, its failure to break up cartels, even when those cartels were in clear violation of Japanese law. Japan did have anti-monopoly and fair trade laws, but for decades the government did not enforce laws on price fixing or other forms of collusion. In fact, it allowed and even encouraged keidetsu. A prime example is the Japanese electronics industry. MITI had a small direct role. It promoted Japanese research in transistors. But more important was the government's role in allowing Japanese electronics industry members to fix prices. In the 1960s and 1970s, seven major firms actively colluded to sell televisions at or below cost in the U.S., while charging more than twice as much for comparable products in Japan. And they were able to do this because they had tight control over the domestic retail system. Most Japanese retailers were small shops, and they were rewarded with special support if they sold at the official price. And they were threatened with a supply cutoff if they tried to cut prices. And there were no independent retailers big enough to push back against price fixing. Now, in the case of TVs, when the gap in prices became known in Japan, MITI felt that they had to explain the gap without acknowledging price fixing. So they asked the electronics industry to explain why a TV costing 150,000 yen, or about $415 in Japan, cost only 65,000 yen, or about $180 in the U.S. And the explanations were completely ridiculous. The industry claimed that 19,000 yen of the difference was due to high sales costs in Japan. But then the Retailers Association refused to take the blame. They insisted that they weren't seeing huge profit margins. And the electronics industry further claimed that 15,000 yen in difference was because Japanese TVs were of higher quality in Japan, which no one believed either. And finally, the industry said that 16,100 yen in difference was due to other. They didn't even try to explain that. Now, this lame explanation got a terrible public response, and the Japanese public was so angry that the Japanese Homemakers Association organized a brief boycott of TV sales. So the industry had to back off a little. They signed a consent decree with the Japanese Fair Trade Commission, and they lowered the differential between U.S. and Japanese prices from over 100% more in Japan to only about 60% more. And then they went on fixing prices, both domestically and in the U.S. market. So why was Japan selling TVs so cheaply in the U.S.? Well, the basic goal was to gain market share and drive U.S. producers out of business, and both strategies worked. The number of U.S. TV manufacturers fell from 27 in 1960 to 5 in 1980. Meanwhile, Japanese manufacturers gained something close to 50% of the U.S. market. And then they carefully coordinated price increases so that they were no longer selling on tiny or even negative margins. Now, in the 1970s, these practices drew a hostile response in the U.S. The Japanese economy had gotten so big that America just couldn't keep absorbing Japanese imports. And the U.S.-Japanese relationship changed. The U.S. shifted from promoting Japanese exports to blocking them. This was an incredibly rapid change. In a period of just a few years, the U.S. abandoned its support for the cheap yen, and between 1971 and 1973, the yen appreciated by 20% against the dollar. And by 1980, it was up 50%. Also, the U.S. began introducing tariffs to block imports from Japan. In fact, Nixon insisted that he had the authority as president to impose the tariffs without congressional approval because of the 1917 Trading with the Enemy Act. That decision did not play well in Tokyo. And this was part of a still broader shift in U.S. policy. Remember that Japan was supposed to be the Asian capitalist success story. It was supposed to be the antidote to Chinese communism. But that storyline also began to break down in the 1970s. Nixon flew to China, chatted with Mao, and began the process of recognizing the People's Republic rather than Taiwan as the government of China. Now in Tokyo, this was a complete shock. The Japanese Foreign Ministry had not been given advance notice. They found out from public media. And coming on top of those developments was the 1973 oil crisis. And as a U.S. ally, Japan was specifically targeted as part of the OPEC embargo. And the Japanese economy suffered as oil prices rose 300% in just a few years. Now, in the 1970s, many suggested that this was the end of Japan's economic growth, because many of the fundamentals of Japanese post-war growth were gone. U.S. support for exports, gone. A cheap yen, gone. Cheap labor, all gone. But the Japanese economy actually rebounded from the crisis of the early 1970s rather quickly, and growth continued, although at a slower rate, down from about 8% per year to around 4%. Japanese companies also adapted to the new relationship with the U.S. They began moving production to the U.S. to work around import restrictions. And they also began buying American companies. For example, Panasonic bought the consumer electronics division of Motorola to maintain access to the U.S. market. And the rise in gas prices gave Japanese cars an advantage since Japanese automobiles were quicker to raise fuel efficiency. And Japanese car companies moved up in the market. As early as 1983, Toyota began planning the Lexus. Now, Japanese cars were already known as cheap and reliable, but now Toyota began planning for